This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here. This is the big picture. It's where we try to put some sense into all of those intelligence dots that you see out there. You know, one of the subjects that we have touched on briefly from time to time with some various analysts are the changes that are happening inside the retail landscape. This week on FS Insider, Chris Sheridan interviewed Matt Townsend, co-author of the new Bloomberg report, Retail Apocalypse. So what we're going to do is pick up on that theme and weave it with brand moats and the investment implications for that. Because right now we're in one of the biggest retail, or actually the biggest retail season of the year. And we'll look at that combined with longer term trends in the retail industry, and then that how that will shape investment trends in the future.
You know, I think probably the best place to start off, John, is to begin with a trend that is accelerating, which is store closures. Now, we did a program on this earlier in the year with an analyst, and it is one trend that has accelerated after the financial crisis, and especially with the introduction of the smartphone, which ushered in the digital age. There was a story, I think almost a third of all the online sales, I think on Thanksgiving Day, were done on smartphones. And just to give you an idea of how this trend is taking place and how it's shaping up, according to the Bloomberg report, retailers announced that they were opening up 3,000 stores this year. So on the surface, it sounds like retail's expanding. But on the other side of it, over 6,800 stores announced they would be closing this year. And that's just in the first three quarters of the year. There will be more in the fourth quarter. So store closings began to exceed openings beginning right around 2014, and it's now accelerating, especially this year, and it's going to accelerate even further and faster and much deeper in the years ahead. The problem is this thing started long before online sales and the digital age. And that's part of this is technology in some sense. I mean, the main issue to begin with is America has been overstored. And we did a interview with Howard Davidowitz earlier a couple of years ago, and then Chris Sheridan did one with him this year. And if you take a look at how demographic growth has happened in the U.S. It's from the big city. It's been growth out to the suburbs from the east to the west coast. And what happened is a lot of money poured into commercial real estate as the real estate trend of movement to the suburbs accelerated in the last half century. But a result of that, as the suburb developments developed, what came in right with that was the development of the shopping centers, large commercial spaces, which gave way to America has more stores, more shopping centers than any other country in the world. Nobody even comes close to us.
We have more retail space per person than any country on a planet Earth. We're overstored, but we're not just overstored in department stores. We're overstored in everything. We're overstored in malls. Half of our malls will disappear in 20 years. Half. We're overstored in strip centers. We're overstored in power centers. We're overstored in everything. We have too much of everything. And that's why stores are shrinking and Walmart is growing with smaller stores, and so is everyone else.
That was a clip from Howard Davidowitz earlier in the year. And, you know, John, it wasn't just the movement of, let's say, out to the suburbs. It also started with the big box stores. We had Sears, then we had Kmart, then along came Walmart. And then it was the big department stores, the Macy's, the Nordstrom's, the May Company. And then, of course, along with the big department stores, they became the key anchors to what we got were the super malls. And everything became big box. Everything from Walmart to Staples to Petco to Dick's Sporting Goods Equipment. Every category of retailing went big. Now, that trend is reversing itself and accelerating as a result of three major trends. So it's not just one thing that you can point yourself to like, oh, well, I guess it's online retailing. It's actually much more than that.
Okay, Jim, what are the trends? Now, online shopping, every time you talk about going to the store for something, one of my friends goes, oh, I just click on Amazon and I do all my shopping there. So I guess online shopping is one. Is there something else I'm missing?
Well, I mean, online shopping is absolutely at the top of the list. I mean, it's just so convenient with your smartphone or your laptop or your tablet just to sit there and shop online. And you can get your size. You can get just about everything. And if you take a look at Amazon, which is the big gorilla, I mean, they deliver 7 days a week now. So online shopping is number one. Number two is Howard Davidowitz just mentioned in that clip, is the country is overstored as a result of the movement to the suburbs. And number three, and this is something that Bloomberg talks about in its piece, it was highly touched upon in Chris Sheridan's interview with Matt Townsend, it is overburdened with debt that is coming due in the next 5 to 6 years. And on top of those three trends, I'd probably throw in a fourth trend that is kind of a generational thing, and that is experience versus things. And we're seeing this right now as a broad shift away in consumer spending, away from, let's say, apparel, accessories, and things towards things like dining, travel, and entertainment. So if with a lot of millennials, it's more about the experience than it is about acquiring stuff. So the malls that survive in the future are going to be much different. And you're already seeing this trend right now in some of the malls that are renovating. You're seeing more restaurants. You're seeing movie theaters. And the stores are going to become much smaller, and they're going to focus on the in-store customer experience. You're seeing this somewhat with Nordstrom's, where they're opening up like sort of coffee shops, Nordstrom's Cafe. So they're moving more towards an experience in entertainment than just shopping. So the whole experience is going to adjust, and we'll get to in a moment. There's a whole new multi-channel direction that retail is taking and is going to form over the next decade.
The online store and the overstoration, there's a new word, we'll use that one, the overstoration that we're seeing right now. I mean, those are pretty obvious, but now debt, and that's something I hadn't thought of before. Is this a junk bond issue or something like that?
Well, I mean, if you think of a lot of these stores, they were opening up new stores all the time in suburbs and new areas. A lot of those store openings were financed with taking on debt. And the problem is the big shakeout that you're seeing now with store closing is debt is fine when things are going well. But when you have a shrinking business model is happening to many of these retailers, I was just looking at statistics for this last past weekend shopping. Store traffic was down 4% this year. It was down 3% last year. So the day after Thanksgiving mayhem at the malls, John, is coming to an end. So there's less and less people going. And so the problem that these retailers have is they expanded into many of these areas, opened up more stores than they can support in a geographic region. And a lot of that was taken on with massive amount of debt. Now, the problem is the retailers who have been fortunate enough until recently, they've been able to avoid bankruptcy by refinancing their debt in a low interest rate environment. And it's not just the retailers. It was energy companies. When the price of oil fell from 110 bucks all the way down to 26, they thought there was going to be much greater fallout in the energy sector. The reason there wasn't is because of the low interest rates. As we've talked about on the program, you've seen a compression here of high yield debt down in terms of the spread over sovereign debt. And that has narrowed considerably. And what that's done, it's breathed life into a lot of companies that quite honestly wouldn't be around today had they, let's say, refinanced their debt at a higher interest rate. But now bond investors are taking a dim view on retailers, making it harder for them to refinance. And on top of that, you add the fact that we're in a rate raising environment with the Fed expected to raise interest rates next month. And so as they do that, the cost of borrowing for many of these people are going to get to be cost prohibitive, and many of them simply won't be able to make it. In fact, we're seeing it. We got a glimpse of this in September with big box toy seller Toys R Us filed for bankruptcy in September this year, making it the third largest bankruptcy in retail bankruptcy in history. And so you're seeing more and more, and they're predicting next year you're going to see more of that, because what happens is this year, I think the figure in the Bloomberg report is there's about $100 million of debt that needs to be refinanced. Next year, that figure rises to $1.9 billion, and thereafter, it averages $5 billion a year. And so this is one of the big issues that we're going to be facing here, is these retailers have to begin rolling over their debt in a rate-raising environment, and also the possibility that by the end of 2019, we could actually be in a recession, which would make matters even worse.
If you look at high-yield debt, this year there was only $100 million of high-yield debt coming due among big retailers. Next year it balloons to $2 billion, and then over the next 5 to 6 years, it's $5 to $6 billion. So it paints this picture of, we've had all these bankruptcies happen this year, but there's still all this debt, and it's really just coming due starting next year. And when it starts coming due, that's when retailers are going to struggle to refinance it, to pay it off. And that's really what drives the company into bankruptcy, and what drives the company out of business is they can't service their debt. So it doesn't paint a pretty picture. And the other thing to mention is that over the next 5 to 6 years, when all this high-yield retail debt is coming due, there's also $1 trillion worth of high-yield debt coming due in all industries. So there's going to be all this demand for all these companies with high-yield debt to do something with their debt, restructure it, refinance it. And so there's going to be huge demand and not as many people willing to potentially do that, because potentially credit markets get tighter and it becomes just not as appealing of an investment for investors to help out these companies with their debt. So that's why we're sort of painting this picture of, it really hasn't even started yet, this retail apocalypse, which is kind of a scary thought.
You know, you can see this with the retailers getting it on all sides. They're having to compete at lower prices with online behemoths like Amazon, say, for example. They have to lure people in by putting things on sale. And that, of course, lowers their margin between cost and sale price. And then finally, now they're going to have to deal with debt. So in all different ways, they're thrashing around trying to stay afloat.
Yeah, and right now, like I said earlier, they've been able to dodge a bullet, because up until now, the junk bond market has been robust. It's up nearly 20% like the stock market over the last 12 months, because the junk bond market in many ways functions just like the stock market. It does well. In fact, if you looked at junk bonds, you actually would have made more money over the last couple of years in junk bonds than you did in the stock market. But it's bad news for retailers, as Matt Townsend was just talking about, because all of that debt is coming due at the same time, with the biggest amount, the first tranche, is going to start in the year 2019. So if you're a retailer, if you can, you ought to refinance now when interest rates are lower, because they're probably going to be a lot higher a year from now with more Fed rate hikes. And then it begins to accelerate in the years 2021 and 2023, all the way to the years 2025. So this is debt that's going to be rolling over every single year, averaging about $5 billion. And John, if we get into a recession, if the Fed raises interest rates in December three more times next year, as they're projecting, that's another 1% increase in interest rates. And if you start getting into a low or slow economic environment, which is why we're going to cover the issue of taxes here in the big picture this week, because you're talking about extending the business cycle further out by at least a good year, versus, let's say, a recession that could begin much earlier. So this is why this is going to be a very, very tough environment to operate on. Because you imagine right now, you've got the lowest unemployment that we've seen in almost two decades. You have consumer sentiment at a very high level. If you have that optimism, and also if we get tax cuts for the middle class out of this package, that's going to put more dollars in the pocket. So consumers are feeling very optimistic. You've seen it in shopping. Black Friday has been pretty good for retailers in general. And also it's been terrific, of course, for online retailing. And many of those retailers are moving in that direction, whether it's Walmart, Target, or even Nordstrom's are moving in that direction. So it's a good environment for the customer right now, and it's a good environment for the store because people are spending money. What happens when you get into a recession? People lose their jobs. People get scared. They get tighter with their money. Retail sales contract just like revenues do in the slower growth economy or in a recession. And imagine at that point, then all of a sudden you get the spreads that widen in the bond market, which is going to raise the cost for these retailers trying to restructure or roll over that debt. So, you know, they've been fortunate up to about 2014. They've been in a bull market with high consumer confidence, extremely low interest rates, and that has pushed out the day of reckoning. Unfortunately, as Matt Townsend and his co-authors talk about in their article or their report, Retail Apocalypse is Just Beginning, that day is coming soon and can begin as soon as next year.
There is another trend that's also accelerating as we watch it. Big box stores, sometimes I guess you look at Target and Walmart, they've decided they maybe don't need as much floor space as they had before in their operation. So there may be changes coming in terms of those. A couple of them won't probably. I'm not sure Walmart's going to do that, but even so, they may want to shut down X number of stores. We've got, let me see here, at least three in our immediate area, and we don't need that many for a community of this size. And so you can see the downsizing just in numbers of stores coming.
Yeah, and a lot of the stores, and you're seeing this with Walmart's response to Amazon, they're putting a lot of their big ticket items that, you know, you need a van or a truck to haul, they're putting that online so customers can go to their online, order it, and have it shipped to their home rather than trying to get a truck or a van loaded into the car, especially if you're buying like a big screen TV, 65, 75 inch TV. How are you going to fit that in your car? And then they're putting the stuff that is high turnover, they're putting that in the store. Well, if you're not selling as many big box items in the store, you don't need as much space. And a lot of Walmart is even talking about home deliveries, just like Amazon, which is why you're going to see Amazon move into the brick and mortar space, because 50% of Amazon's cost is fulfillment cost, which is basically getting the goods to your home.
You know, Jim, one of the things, though, that I'm going to throw something toward the actual storefront stores like Best Buy. I had to get some electronic equipment this week. Yeah, I can order stuff on Amazon. That's easy to do. But sometimes when I'm pricing various pieces of electronic equipment, I want to go in and have a hands-on, you know, tactile look and talk with one of the sales reps about the different ways these functions and customer feedback and all of that. You can compare prices more easily on Amazon, but you can't get this hands-on feeling. Now, the flip side of that, and usually when I do that, I try to buy from the store to support them. But the flip side is what a lot of people are doing is going into the stores, talking to the clerk, blah, 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 and then they go home and order it on Amazon for cheaper. And so the store expends its overhead, but the people get the benefit by ordering online, you know. But there's no substitute sometimes for being able to touch things and look at things.
Yeah, and the stores are getting very savvy to that because they know there's a lot of people that have their smartphones with them when they go in the store. You're right, John. You're going to shop for a TV set, you want to go in a store, whether it's Costco, Best Buy, you want to look at the TV set. You want to see the quality of the picture. And the stores are getting savvy enough to know that you probably have some app, you're shopping around town. And the smarter stores, I know Best Buy does this, they'll match the price. And so, you know, they don't want you to walk in, look, and take a salesman's time. They do all the work, and then you walk out and buy it someplace online. You know, you can get it right there, assuming they have it in stock, and walk right out with it, and they'll match the price. And this is what's depressing some of the margins. And we'll get into margin suppression in brands in terms of what's happening to the brands as well. But you're right. You know, I recently bought a suit. And, you know, I can't see shopping for a suit online, although they do have, believe it or not, like anything else, if you have a smartphone, there's a company, I'm not going to mention their name, but they have an app, John, that you can hold the app and it'll digitally measure you for, like, if you're going to order a pair of pants or a shirt and they can ship it to you. I mean,
I could come up with some jokes on that one. Okay.
Yeah, I know. I know, but I mean, that's where we're going. We are going to go to almost virtual reality. In the stores of the future will be, instead of looking at displays of merchandise, you might go up to a kiosk, look at items, pick the items you like, go into a virtual dressing room and look in front of a mirror, and they'll put those items on you digital wise. And that's where we're heading to. But, you know, there is some truth to the idea that there's just something about walking into a store, viewing something, touching something. There's a tactile experience that you can't get online. But watch Amazon. They're doing this with apparel. You'll be able to order clothes from Amazon. They'll ship them to you. You try on the things you like and the things you don't like. When your shipment arrives, you're also going to get another package of boxes that will have a return for it. So you'll try on the things you like that fit you, and the ones you don't, you send back in a return box. Eventually, with their data mining, they'll start having fewer returns, but they're even going to hit that. But I don't know. There's just something about going to a store, looking at something, trying it on, feeling the texture of the fabric. I don't know. It's going to be hard to replace that in, let's say, with holograms or digitally. I just, you know, it's like, I don't know about you, John. I have a Kindle, but I much prefer to read a book. I like having something in my hands. I have these little flags that I put and I underline stuff if I'm going to interview an author or important points of the book that I can always go back to. So, you know, I'm a tactile person. I like to have something in my hands, and that's why I prefer books.
Yeah, and sometimes, like yesterday, you know, you've got a radio studio here. You need equipment. I need it now. I don't need it on 24-hour overnight delivery. Something has to happen. Radio Shack, it was fun because whenever you had an emergency, you ran in and said, give me this, that, and, oh, that resistor over there. Thank you very much. How much do I owe you? And you walked out. You can't always do that on Amazon.
Now, you know, they're getting better and better on their fulfillment and overnight service, but not everything. I mean, there's something about being able to drive up to a store, see it, touch it, and walk out with it. But, you know, it is these store closings, John, it's hitting all across the board in the retail space. Over 550 department stores are closing today with 43 million square feet of space that's going to go empty. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But this year, so far, as of Q3, there's been over 6,700 store closings. 2,500 of them have been in apparel, over 1,900 in home entertainment, 735 in footwear, 553 department stores, miscellaneous retail, 415, 240 bookstores closed. That's kind of sad because my favorite thing to do on Saturday is always to go into the Barnes & Noble, look at the new books, the magazines. I don't know. I just love being in the bookstore. Most of the new ones have like a Starbucks in them, and it's a nice experience. Once again, that kind of entertainment experience being in the store. 155 sporting goods stores, and there's 3,000 announced store openings. Now, here in contrast, 879 in apparel, 177 in department stores, and 693. So you can see the trend, 60% more stores closing than the 40% stores that are opening. So this trend is going to continue, and it's going to accelerate, especially when those debt loads start coming through. You're going to see those stores have to restructure their debt. They're going to have to unload property. They're going to have to walk away from leases. And that has a lot of implications for investors, especially in the investment markets.
Yeah, the other thing that I've seen expand too, at the supermarket, I know our chain Fred Meyer's here in the Northwest now has, you can shop online, go through their store, you label the product, you internet in your order, and you pull up at special parking places, and they come out and go, here's your order, and you drive off. You don't even have to go into the store. But I agree with you. You know, the bookstores, I want to smell the books, you know, the different printing materials and everything, and look at it and feel it. And you can't get that. Now, as those stores close, however, there are a lot of middle class jobs, from salespeople to clerks and stockers and everything that's tied with it, that are going to go away. And those will transfer to the fulfillment clerks at Amazon and other online big places. Yes, there'll be more jobs there for specific locations around the country, but you'll see a decline in jobs elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Amazon is opening up a lot of fulfillment centers, so there's a lot of jobs. But the one thing you'll notice in a Amazon warehouse is the dearth of people. I mean, a lot of the work is being done by robots. So there are new jobs being created. I think Amazon is going to be hiring over 100,000 people. And so there are jobs that are being created, but there are a lot of jobs that are going to be displaced, from clerks, salespeople, to just maintenance people that keep these stores up and running. So a lot of jobs are going to go. So that is just a trend, John, that we're going to see the whole landscape change. Who would have ever thought these little devices, whether it's an iPod, an iPad, or a smartphone, would change and usher us into the digital age, and the transformation of taking place in the economy as a result. I mean, we think of technology, but we also have to think of the consequences of this new technology that's coming in, how it's transforming the economic landscape.
Having said all of this, if we shove it all to one side, how do you envision retail looking like in the future when all of this shakes out?
You know, the trend is going to change. I think the next phase of retailing is moving to what I call the multi-channel era, where you see integration of the web, social media, and brick and mortar. You're starting to see it with stores like Walmart. You're seeing it as they ramp up their online presence. You're seeing it with Nordstrom's. But you're going to see Amazon also in this space as well. And what you may see, because Amazon's model is not economically sustainable. And if you look at Amazon's profits, you know, it's made very little profit in its 20 years of its existence. In fact, most of that profit has probably come in the last couple of years. So they know they have to have some kind of brick and mortar presence because their fulfillment cost over 50% of what it costs to get the goods to you. So they are sacrificing profits for growth. And at some point, you're going to have some kind of brick and mortar presence. And, you know, you can see it. They bought Whole Foods. You may see them end up buying a struggling retailer like Macy's or a national convenience chain or something that's going to give them a larger footprint in brick and mortar space in the major metropolitan areas. Because if they can do that, that ramps up and lowers the cost of their fulfillment. And that's what they need to do, because eventually, I mean, you can sell the story on growth, which Amazon has been very successful in doing for two decades. But if you look at them as a profitable company, they're not very profitable. Walmart makes more money. Costco makes more money than Amazon does. So sooner or later, I think you're going to see them move into that space. And Amazon's greatest expense, as I pointed out, is shipping. And their goal of being able to reach more and more households in less time means they're going to need a brick and mortar presence, and look for Amazon, which has a grossly overinflated stock, to use that cheap form of capital to acquire brick and mortar space at a discount. So they're in the driver's seat, but you're going to see that change. You're also going to see the transition, and you're seeing this, I don't know if you have it in places where you live, John, you're going to see malls become more like entertainment centers. They're going to integrate it with movie theaters. You're going to integrate it with restaurants. So it's going to be more of a social experience. Once again, that trend of experience versus the accumulation of things. And this is one of the problems that the retailers are struggling for right now, because as this transition takes place, the brick and mortar retailers are behind effectively using their data mining as effective as Amazon does. Have you ever noticed when you go on Amazon and you buy something, the next time you log in, what do you see? You see similar items or related items immediately up there. They're monitoring your shopping habits, what you do, what you like, what you browse. I mean, 50% of all product searches begin on Amazon. And this is something that the brick and mortar retailers have been ineffective in doing. There is a great article in the Wall Street Journal talking about the brick and mortar retailers kind of upping their online presence, but their emails have been ineffective. They talked about one gal that was shopping for boots at Lord & Taylor, and she gets an email back on dresses. And, you know, here she is looking for boots and shoes, and they get an email response from the retailer on dresses, which she wasn't looking for. So they're behind the eight ball on that, and that's hurting them. But the smart ones are expending a lot of money in catching up. They're going to have to, or they're not going to survive.
The driver that I do see for online retailing, for example, here, supplies and things that we use on a recurrent basis, I don't have to go into town. I don't have to go to a particular store, brave the traffic, get dressed, do everything that. It just comes on a regular basis. And you even have the order, the previous orders that you're going to reorder for the following month. You just punch it in and there it is. And it's delivered. You don't have to do any more. It's very quick to achieve. So it is one of the advantages. Certain things that you know what you want, you can just simply get them.
Yeah. I mean, I drink a special kind of water that's made here in California. It's oxygenated and it's the best tasting water. Now, if I go into the store, sometimes I may be lucky getting it for $2.50 a bottle, sometimes $2.75, depending on where I'm shopping. John, I get four cases of the stuff delivered to me once a month from Amazon for $2 a bottle. So, I mean, that's something I'm not doing. And it's also going to be another thing that you're going to see And that is, you're seeing it right now with companies like Blue Apron, Green Chef, where you can actually order, it's kind of like cook by numbers, organic food, any kind of dishes. I mean, I use Green Chef, and it arrives at your doorstep. It's organic. It's all color-coded for you. That has a sheet, what to do, what to cook, what utensils. So, you know, I'm doing that. Now, what does that mean? Let's put it this way. I could not make that meal, go to a store, and shop for the goods that I'm going to put in that meal that I get from Green Chef. And so what does that mean? I'm spending less at the grocery store. So grocery stores are getting hit not only by the Amazons in the world. I no longer buy my water at the store. I get it delivered from Amazon. So a lot of this is going to change, and a lot of it is just convenience.
The big takeaway from why online sales are doing so well is that it's convenience. It makes things easy. It's not necessarily price. I mean, for some people, it's price. But for some people, especially people, you know, are busier, parents with kids, I mean, the ease of just clicking and getting that thing delivered to your house, you're maybe even willing to pay more, which kind of gets to your point. So why do you go to a store? I mean, that's the big question. It's why do you need to go to a physical store? Why would you want to go to a physical store? And that's what the whole industry is kind of struggling with.
That was a clip of Chris Sheridan's interview with Matt Townsend, one of the co-authors of the new Bloomberg report called America's Retail Apocalypse. And if you haven't been by FSN Insider lately, highly recommend that you go by and take a look. We've just had a series of great, great guests that we've been put on the program with great insights for investors. And Chris has been doing a real high quality job. And we've been fortunate enough to have some high guests. But that was from a clip from the Townsend interview that was featured on our site this week. But this brings me, John, to my next topic that I want to weave into this. It's not just that online smartphones, the digital age is changing retail commerce. It is also assaulting brand moats that have been established over decades and decades of, you know, literally billions and hundreds of billions of dollars of advertising that have been used to create this brand and this brand loyalty. And this is impacting the big brand companies. There was a study done recently of affluent shoppers, if they could identify their favorite brand. And the study was done between 2007 and 8 and 2014 and 15. And just listen to the way the world has changed. In 2007, 80% of those affluent shoppers could identify a favorite brand. That figure dropped to 61% by 2015. When it came to jewelry in 2007, 58% could identify a brand like Tiffany's, Rolex. It was down to 40% by 2015. Luxury hotels, it dropped from 67% to 37%, and brand retailers from 47% down to 28%. That is big trouble. And you can see it from some of these big companies like Procter & Gamble, which dominated men's razors with Gillette. And their success, they would come out with this new shaving technology, which I still think is the best in the world, and they would charge a premium for it. Well, what happened? You had companies like Shave Club and Harry's move in on Gillette's space, and they lost a large percentage of their dominance of men's shaving. So what did they do? They're fighting back in response, just as you're seeing Walmart do. They have come out and they're rolling out a new line. And if you take a look at the Gillette Fusion is $3.75. Schick Hydro is $3.82. If you look at the next category of blades, Harry's 5 blades is $2.75. The Gillette 5 is now $2.50. And the Gillette Mach 3 is $2.50. And you've got Dollar Shave Club there at 2.25. And then you've got Gillette 3 down to $2. So Gillette is coming back. And what they're doing is they're going to take their technology and they're going to use that technology and not charge for it and compete on price on razors. And this is happening to all brand images. And it's going to affect not only companies like Procter & Gamble, it's going to affect a lot of these companies like, you know, your branded food that you see in the supermarkets. And you're going to see major brands do this because it's the only way they're going to be able to compete. And you're seeing it already. I do the grocery shopping in our family. So one of the trends that you see in the grocery store is, number one, stores are going more to their in-house generic brands, which are cheaper. And you're seeing a movement to fresh goods versus canned and processed, which are healthier for you. And you're seeing it also, as I mentioned earlier, by companies like Blue Apron and Green Chef, which are competing with grocery stores for food. I can actually cook a meal for Mary and I cheaper by going through Green Chef than I can by going to the grocery store. And it's all organic. It is fun. By the time I'm done, it looks like a restaurant meal. So that's taking money away that I used to spend at a grocery store. So these are trends that are going to change, but the overall trend is going to be a multi-channel trend where you're going to see brick and mortar mesh with social and e-commerce come together in one package. And it's just in the development stage, but some of these companies like Nordstrom's and Walmart are already moving in that direction.
You know, let's talk about Costco, because when I go over to Costco, and no matter what, I've been to a bunch of them around the country over the last year, and you enjoy walking in. The products, what they produce, are generally very, very good. And yes, you're not going to find everything like in a Walmart or something, but you'll find key things that you need.
And you know what? Costco has done a great job with their in-house brands, the Kirkland brand. They don't even advertise for it, and look how popular it is. And the other thing they do is they keep bringing the price. What they make on margin on the goods they sell basically covers their overhead. A good majority of Costco's profits come from that membership fee. So yeah, there's just something about walking into a Costco, whether you're tasting the samples on the weekends or just taking a look at the stuff they bring in seasonally. It's always a great place to go and a great experience.
Okay, so boiling this down, Jim, what does this mean for investors then?
Well, the one thing, as we talked about, one of the big issues here that's going to hit the retailers beginning in 2019 is all of this debt that's going to have to be rolling over. And that's why you're going to see more and more store closings. So if you're invested in real estate investment trusts, you better take a look at what they own. If you own or invested in a REIT that has a high concentration in commercial shopping centers, you're at risk. The second thing is the junk bond market. Right now, it's been favorable. You know, if you've been in junk bonds the last year, your returns have been commensurate with the stock market, almost 20%. As we get closer and closer towards a recession, and as the Fed raises interest rates, you could see junk bond spreads widen. So that could be trouble in the junk bond market, because a lot of these bonds are going to be defaulted on or restructured and renegotiated. The other thing that you're going to see is the premium that is on these brand companies. I don't care if it's Campbell's, General Mills, Procter & Gamble, Kellogg's, all these name brand products that you get, they're coming increasingly under pressure. I mentioned the idea of Gillette, which came out with new technology, priced it at a high price, and they own the razor market. That's not the case anymore. They are now having to offer that technology, not charge a premium, and lower their prices. So the PE ratios and the multiples are going to diminish on many of these branded companies because their moats are no longer secure as they once were. And fourth, I think it's going to be a deflationary trend, which is actually good for consumers because everybody is going to be competing for your retail dollars. And that's good news for you as a consumer. In the end, cheaper prices, more convenient, the best of both worlds. And that's this new multi-channel retail world that we're moving in. So the malls of the future, you're probably going to see them coupled with movie theaters. You're going to see a lot more what I call restaurants, entertainment. It's going to be more of a social experience, more so than just walking into a store. The stores will probably be smaller. And the next areas that are going to come under assault by online commerce are going to be apparel, food, and finally jewelry, which has some of the highest markups of any kind of retail good that is sold.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Just from anecdotal evidence, this smells like a bubble. And like you said, there's probably some long-term validity for cryptocurrencies. But is there validity for Bitcoin to appreciate as much as it has in 1 year? That's something that's open to debate, and I would have to say probably not. And everything I'm seeing anecdotal-wise does tell me we're in a bubble. Let me give you an example. I know someone who's an investment advisor, and he had his son's baseball coach come up to him and said, hey, I bought $150,000 worth of Bitcoin. I don't know what it is. I just know it's going up. $150,000 in Bitcoin, has no idea what it is. And he did that, I believe it was early November, so he actually doubled his money and made $150,000, given what Bitcoin's done. But that was someone who knew absolutely nothing what it was, but just wanted to speculate in it. How does that not smell of a bubble? Let me give you another example. There are a few of our clients who, you know, they lean on the more apocalyptic side and thinking that we're going to have a huge crash right around the corner. So they've been in cash for years. I'm talking 3, 4, even 5 years. And I've reached out to them, tried to get them invested, at least even in short-term bonds to earn something, at least keep them up with the rate of inflation. And they won't even return calls. And then you hear out of the woodworks, they give me a call and say, hey, what do you think about Bitcoin? I can't get them to buy a 3-month T-bill, but they want to buy Bitcoin.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. What a circus this week in the Senate, if you were watching on Friday, as they were jiggering and rejiggering and recalculating and redebating and whatever they were redoing to try to get a vote. And obviously, we're talking about the tax bill. This week was dominated by news of a possible passage of a tax bill in the Senate. This whole idea of tax reform, which I think we should both point out here, this is not a tax reform bill, but that's what it's been touted as. But it's been a main driver of the stock market to record highs ever since the promise of that appeared after the elections. And despite pullbacks on Friday, there have been major gains in all the indices. This is good for investors, and with likely passage of a tax bill, the real question is, what does this mean for the markets going forward, especially when you consider the possibility of tax cuts? This has been a major drive of stock prices this year. What happens as we carry forward from this point?
With the bill as it's currently shaped, John, it's probably good news for companies, and especially those that could have lower tax brackets. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen stocks move up as much as they have this week. But for multinational companies, and I'm really talking about the big guys, the S&P 500, your Dow 30 stocks, especially those with big capital budgets, clean balance sheets, because as they lower tax rates, they're also going to limit interest expense or put a cap on it. This bill is going to be a plus. And it would be a plus for 5 specific reasons. Number one, they would lower the tax rate from 35 to 20. Obviously, if they lower your tax rates by 60%, that means more dollars to the bottom line. Number two, they're going to have a one-time special rate on repatriated profits. So if you're stuck with, you know, billions and billions of dollars overseas that you don't want to bring back because you're going to have to pay 35% tax rates, well, if you can pay a 10 or 14% tax rate, obviously you're going to be better off. And who knows what that number is going to end up to be. That's one of the things that we saw going back and forth on Friday. They kept jiggering this rate. Well, if we raise it to this rate, we can save a few dollars here and apply them someplace else. So this is still a fluid process, so we really don't know what it is. But repatriated profits would be good. It would also bring in tax revenues to the government. Intellectual property rights, bringing them back. Global minimum tax, which we're going to go more towards a global tax system, so we'll be in sync with the rest of the world, and a number of minor provisions. But this would be a big windfall to a lot of these tech and pharmaceutical companies that have literally billions of overseas profits. I mean, Amgen is $39 billion overseas, Pfizer 22. It's a big windfall for a lot of these pharmaceutical companies. Apple sitting on $250 billion. Microsoft is sitting on, what, $40, $50 billion. So obviously, if these companies can bring that money back, we did this under Bush, W. Bush, back in, I think it was 2003, one of the tax bills, they said, hey, if you bring it back, we'll tax it at 5%. And some of that money made its way back. But since it was temporary, not too much money came back. And what they're trying to do here is create a one-time opportunity and then a equalized tax rate, whether you bring it home or not. In other words, they just don't want you to bring it home, but then they don't want you piling up profits if the one-time tax expires. So they're going to go to a universal type tax. And if you have those profits overseas, whether you decide to bring them back or leave them there, you're going to end up paying tax on it. So the lower tax rates would boost profits for S&P 500 companies. It's estimated by about 8% for next year. So, John, that's going to be good for stocks and it'll be good for the stock market short term.
All right. So that's the plus. There are some pluses involved in this whole thing. Downsides. Let's take a look at that.
There's three major ones that come to mind. Number one, this is going to be a tax increase on upper middle class and wealthy in high tax states or states with a high cost of living. There was an article that came out on Thursday by the Wall Street Journal with John Hilsenrath. And what they did is they took five different couples. They took one couple that lived in a state that had no state income taxes. They took one individual, a single individual that lived in the state of California with high taxes. They took a couple with high medical expenses. And for many Americans, taxes are going to go up, especially if you live in a high tax state, New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, California, Oregon, some of those states that have these higher tax rates of 9%, my own state of California being the highest, were 13.3. So taxes are going to go up for upper middle class individuals that live in this state. The one thing you can say about this tax bill, it is going to impact people differently. It's going to impact corporations differently. The second drawdown is the stimulus is coming at the wrong time. They're putting in place stimulus at the time the unemployment rate's down to 4.1% and dropping. GDP is now growing at over 3% for three consecutive quarters. That's the first time we've seen that in almost 8 years. So it's really not needed. In fact, several Fed officials, we'll get into it shortly, have said, why are you guys doing this now? It's really not needed. And number three, it's going to put fiscal policy in direct conflict with the Federal Reserve. And so you're going to have two opposing forces going in the opposite direction, and that never produces a good outcome. So those are the three negative drawbacks that I can see on this.
Let's see if we can take each of those separately. I guess the one most significantly that caught my attention was for quite a number of Americans, this is going to be a major tax increase, not decrease.
Well, I mean, let's take a look at how this is going to impact so many Americans. It's not just those upper income individuals in the high tax states. It's going to be seniors or people with medical expenses or people living in Texas, Louisiana, and Florida that got hit with the hurricanes this past summer. So one of the big things, you know, they keep brandishing this little postcard and say, look, look, look what we're doing. We're simplifying the tax system. Well, what they're not really telling you, and they don't spend too much time, is they're taking away all your itemized deductions. They're taking away the deduction for state and local taxes. Now, depending on the outcome, the House version has a $10,000 cap for property taxes. In California, doesn't mean much, nor does that mean much in New York. Secondly, they are going to limit mortgage deductions from the current million plus $100,000 for a second mortgage. They're going to drop that in half to $500,000. And if you live in one of these high cost of living areas, like along the coast in California, where, you know, in San Francisco, the median price of a house is over $1.4 million, or here in San Diego or in Los Angeles, where it's $600,000 or $700,000, a $500,000 mortgage doesn't buy you a lot of home here in California or in New York City. So they're going to cap that. They're going to do away with medical deductions. Now, this is horse trading that's going on, and we're seeing this go on Friday. And they're also going to take away property and casualty deductions. And basically, they're also going to take away your exemptions. And those exemptions are worth $4,050. They're going to go up to over $4,100 in 2018. So you take a family of four that would have four exemptions, John, that's $16,200. So they try to avoid this and they say, hey, look, we're going to increase the standard deduction by $24,000. We're going to double it. Well, folks, they're really not going to double it because you're going to lose your exemptions. And if you take a family of four that, let's say, does not itemize their deductions, subtract the loss of the personal exemption, and it's really only gone up $8,000. So it really isn't much. So for many individuals in high tax states, their federal taxes are going to go up.
You know, one of the areas where Congress seems to be talking out of both sides of its mouth, we've had this whole fight over the Affordable Health Care Act and the idea that health care should be a right and et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at it here, what they're doing here is cutting back on medical expenses. And we've talked a lot about this on our Lifetime Income series on Mondays here on the program, and how big they can be in retirement, and being able to deduct those expenses, especially the unreimbursed ones that your insurance or Medicare doesn't pay for. This is significant. This is going to be a pretty hard hit for a lot of people.
It sure is. And especially for those, I have a client who called on this because their mother is in a retirement home in Arizona. It's costing $6,500 a month. Well, that $6,500 a month is a deduction on her tax return. So she hasn't paid any federal taxes because of the deduction of those medical expenses. In fact, the Wall Street Journal article did a couple with $40,000 of medical expenses, which is not unusual if you have hospital expenses or a lot of things that aren't covered under a policy. And that couple would see their taxes actually go up. They wouldn't be able to get that deduction. So that's the real big issue here, is they are taking what has been sacred and has reduced taxes for many individuals that have lived in these high tax states. And that's why there are a number of studies that are coming out that saying that this could force and cause a major migration out of high tax states. You know, the one saving grace for those individuals that earn high income in a high tax state is, you know, you save 40% on your federal tax returns because you get to deduct all this stuff. Well, take it all away.
And there's always that Trojan horse, and we've seen it before. You know, you take the deductions away in exchange for theoretically other things that are happening on your return. So they say, see, it's really not so bad. But then the next Congress, the next presidential administration comes in and they raise the tax rates, and lo and behold, you don't have deductions anymore.
Well, that's one of the things that has been pointed out in a lot of analysis that has done this bill. In fact, the Wall Street Journal had a great article a couple of weeks ago, is the gist of the tax bill is we're moving more towards a European socialist type tax system. If you take a look at Europe, they have very low corporate tax rates and they're actually lowering them even further. So lower corporate taxes, higher personal taxes, which is really not good economically. And you can see that in the growth rates in Europe. So, John, this is kind of a shell game. And I've noticed that whenever the Republicans have been on the talk shows and people ask about, hey, you know, this could raise taxes for a lot of people, whether it's medical expenses or people that live in high tax states, they always avoid it. And they talk about the $24,000 standard deduction in the simplification on the postcard that you could file your tax return. It would be that simple. What they forget to tell you is they're taking away all the things that help to lower your taxes. So the first thing that we have to talk about is this is going to raise taxes for many individuals that live in high tax states and a high cost of living states. They generally tend to be go hand in hand. You see it on the East Coast, the West Coast. And then also for medical expenses, it can affect not only seniors, but anybody that undergoes serious medical expenses and has to pay for those expenses out of pocket.
Now, what about timing here? Because we often talk about tax policy working opposite to Federal Reserve policy, but also if you're trying to provide a stimulus to the economy, you know, look at right now, what economy is growing right around 3% and unemployment is down somewhere to about 4%. And so the question is, do you really need a stimulus? And if you provide a stimulus at the wrong time, then what are the results? Or does that mean it's not available when you needed it at the right time?
Well, you just pointed out a couple of key points. In fact, we'll get into this when we talk about the Federal Reserve. We've had economic growth above 3%. It's expected fourth quarter GDP will come in over 3%. So this is three consecutive quarters of 3% economic growth, something we haven't seen in 8 years. The other thing is the unemployment rate is down to 4.1% and heading lower. There's talk next year, if this trend continues, we could be down to a 3.6 or a 3.7% unemployment. Employment rate. So you typically see stimulus coming. You just don't see it at the late end of a business cycle. If you take a look at the last 30, 40 years, you typically get stimulus when you're coming out of a recession. So the last time we had major stimulus was the recession of 2001 under George W. Bush and in 2009 under Barack Obama. The problem is if they stimulate now, then the question is, what do they do when the economy moves into a recession? In other words, you fire all your bullets now, then what's left in the chamber? One of the issues that the Fed may be dealing with in the next downturn. In fact, one key Fed official on Friday, William Dudley, he's head of the New York Fed, made a comment with the economy expanding solidly and the unemployment rate this low. They're going to be watching for the economy to overheat. And we'll talk about with slight hints that we may have to raise rates more than we anticipate. So it's reasonable to ask, as Dudley said, is this the best time to apply fiscal stimulus when the economy is close to full unemployment? It's probably not the best time. So, John, this could be in many ways a strategic blunder. And you just never do this in the late end of a business cycle, and especially when you're going against an opposing force such as tightening monetary policy. It's not a good combination.
And as I mentioned before, we may have the Fed going in one direction and Congress going in the opposite. What about a conflict here between both of these organizations?
Well, if you take a look at what the Fed has been telegraphing to the markets, widely expected, they're going to raise interest rates this month for the third time this year. They have already projected 3 rate hikes going into next year. So that would take us to a Fed funds rate of 2.25. And Dudley kind of hinted that, well, we may have to take a second look at the stimulus. If fiscal stimulus is put into place, we may have to get a little bit more aggressive, hinting that maybe it's more than 3 rate increases. So as fiscal stimulus is applied, monetary policy is going to exert a negative force driving up rates. And what you could end up seeing is the Fed does what it always does, which is crashes the airplane or crash the economy.
So we do have this opposition going on right now and hinting or some hintation. And this new word, we got a new one in there now. The hintation that the Fed may actually get more aggressive. What do we look at investment implications in this scenario?
First indication or implication of this, if they do pass it, it would go into effect January 1st of 2018. It's probably going to extend the life of this business cycle for another year, so we may not get into recession territory into 2019, but I can tell you, we are heading for another recession. They have not repealed the business cycle, and this one is already getting long in the tooth. Same thing in terms of this bull market. So this could extend the business cycle for another year. Number two, this is going to help corporate profits, and that's going to help stock prices. If it's estimated that lower tax rates would increase corporate profits by 8%, if you add a growing economy at 3%, so it could be another good year for corporate profits. That would be good for the stock market in the short term. Number three, if the trend towards asset concentration that we're seeing in these large cap stocks, as I talked about with John Roque in the first hour, you know, we could see eventually a waterfall decline because as I covered on a topic we covered earlier, I think it was in October, we did our coverage on concentration of risk. Just as I was speaking with John Roque in the first hour, he was looking at a number of charts and this high concentration, very similar to what we saw in 1999, where you had 5 tech stocks like Cisco, Microsoft, that were dominating the market and represented almost 16% of the market cap of the S&P. And that's exactly where we are with the big FANG stocks today. So you have a high concentration in ETFs, index funds, and mutual funds. And eventually, when this thing turns in the opposite direction. You could see a waterfall decline in the market, just as these big stocks are the driving force behind the market. And that should give investors a bit of a pause. If you take a look at the underlying trend within the index itself, it's being driven by these large cap stocks. It could end up being a waterfall decline. And number four is rising Fed rate hikes eventually are going to be problems for the credit market, especially the junk bond market. So if problems begin to surface and we are on the road towards a recession and bear market, the thing that we're going to be watching, one of the things we're watching rather closely, is credit spreads and what's happening in the junk bond market. So in the short term, John, this would extend the market cycle further. It would also extend the business cycle further with stimulus. Anytime you spend a whole bunch of money, obviously that's going to have an impact on economic growth. But once again, you've got two opposing forces. And anytime there's been two opposing forces, the winner has always been the Fed. And unfortunately, to the detriment of investors and the economy.
Well, based on what happens going into this weekend, as the dust settles over the final tax bill, we'll be able to take a clearer look at all of the implications of that. As we're going forward toward the end of the year, anything else on the horizon?
No, I would say the big thing to watch for is going to be what the Fed says in December. If they come out, and let's say we get a tax bill, and then they have their FOMC meeting in December, they raise rates, which is widely anticipated, and then they say, well, maybe next year we think we're going to raise rates four times. So watch if they keep it at three or they're going to start raising it. That's one thing to keep a lookout for. And this tax bill itself, how it shapes up, what's going to happen to corporate tax rates, that seems to be bandied back and forth. It's changing almost by the hour, depending on which senator is holding out. And so the big thing for next year is this tax bill, because it has short-term implications in terms of corporate profits and its relatedness to, let's say, stock prices, and then also extending this business cycle. So those are the things we're going to be watching. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.